Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we're seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We're seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it'll be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you're already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is May 8, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is with us for the fifth part of the Traitors Within installment. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And as we have demonstrated over the last four shows in this series, everybody and their brother seems to have known that Alger Hiss was a communist. Rosenfeld knew, he just didn't care because he was a communist himself. And we see that the State Department was permeated and inundated with all of these communist skunks, and they were basically kowtowing to the Soviets. Whatever Stalin, whatever old Uncle Joe asked for, he got, and then 10 times that much.
Well, absolutely, and we'll see that ended with Truman, but Truman wasn't 100% American. I'm sorry, he wasn't 100% on our side, that's for sure. Ended with Truman, but last week we saw the United States, even at the chagrin of Winston Churchill, right, gave half of Europe away to the Soviets freely. That they just gave it to them. And that was at Yalta. And aside from Harry Hopkins was a Soviet agent, and he was one of Roosevelt's closest advisors right from the beginning. A lot of the New Deal came right from Harry Hopkins, and a lot of that was just Bolshevism in America, right?
If the Soviets had said, we need France as a buffer zone against
Britain, they probably would have got it.
Yeah.
They wanted Germany for a buffer zone. They wanted Germany to be a demilitarized buffer zone. Well, if they were our allies, why the hell did they need a buffer zone? Yeah, you know, if they were our allies in the war, why would they need Germany to be a non-militarized buffer zone? That makes no sense whatsoever. Obviously, they were never planning on being our allies, right? But on the other hand, Roosevelt was as much a communist as Stalin was.
And allies like them, who needs enemies?
Right. It's the American and European peoples didn't stand a chance in World War II. They didn't stand a chance in Yalta, as practically the entire world was governed by Jewish communists, or maybe it should be communist Jews, right? And none of the world would admit it. That nobody would admit the Bolsheviks were Jews, and nobody would admit the Jewish communists were running America. That the three players at aside from Harry Hopkins, the three players at Yalta were Avril Harriman. He was a Skull and Bones member and a Yale graduate, right? And Charles E. Bolin, who we proved last week right from the pages of Wikipedia, what was a Russian sympathizer and a communist sympathizer, and Alger Hiss, who we showed last week, had a great deal of influence over Roosevelt, and three or four times men had accused Hiss of being a communist before Roosevelt, and Roosevelt just waved them all off. Because Roosevelt was a damn communist. There's no doubt in my mind Roosevelt was a communist.
Now, Wiki does say that Hiss was accused of being a Soviet spy and was convicted of perjury, and they've locked the page so it cannot be edited. They say that he was defamed basically by people who continually accused him of being a communist.
That's the Jews. That's the Jewish public relations machine running cover for itself. We don't realize that the point they still want to keep this false communist-capitalist dichotomy going. But the truth is that the capitalists have been cooperating with the communists all along. Ever since 1913, the same people that brought Bolshevism to Russia have been in control of capitalism in America. And that can be proven very easily when one examines the fact that Jacob Schiff and Bernard Baruch and the Wall Street bankers that financed and kept in power men like Franklin Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, well, they also financed the Bolshevik Revolution and kept in power Lenin and his successors. That there's no doubt that the and all of this dichotomy is still to this day, that this false capitalist communist dichotomy is still to this day, that the Jews insist on keeping that and clinging to that and hanging on to it. But whether you look at the neocons or whether you look at the progressives and Democratic Party, that they're all Jews and they're all communists. It's absolutely incredible. And the few that aren't Jews are just Shabbos Goyim, that'll be kicked aside the first chance the Jews get.
They say they're conservative, but whose traditions do they want to follow? You know,
I got a quote here, and this quote comes from Richard Nixon, right? This is from, and I quoted from another part of this book a few weeks ago. This is from What Was the Hiss Case, An Answer for Tricia. He wrote this, you know, to his daughter, for his daughter, and it's from a book by Richard Nixon called Six Crises, published in 1962 by Doubleday. The Hiss Case exposed the blindness of the Truman administration and its predecessors to the problem of communist subversion in government. Well, I would say to Roosevelt that the Roosevelt administration was never not supposed to be communist, right? It was communist and everything but name only.
And they certainly weren't blind, though.
Right. It demonstrated the need for we'll see they weren't blind for it right from the mouth of Richard Nixon, right? It demonstrated the need for congressional investigatory bodies like the Committee on Un-American Activities, HUAC, right, which could expose such laxity and, with the help of a mobilized public opinion, could force the executive branch to adopt policies adequate for dealing with the problem. The record of negligence was almost too flagrant to believe. Now, this is Richard Nixon talking. Whitaker Chambers, first made his charges in 1939, that Hiss was a communist, and he repeated them to government officials several times thereafter. Yet, as far as the public record is concerned, the only action taken on his charges until the committee, meaning the House Un-American Activities Committee, started its investigation in 1948. So for 9 years, Hiss was being accused of being a communist, and nobody would investigate, was to promote each of the individuals that he named, and in other words, the Roosevelt administration promoted each of the individuals that Chambers named as a communist to higher positions of power and influence within the government. The most damning proof of negligence on the part of the executive branch, I don't think it's negligence, they were doing what they wanted to do, was that Hiss himself had to be indicted and convicted not for espionage, the crime of which he was originally guilty, but for perjury, for lying when he denied committing espionage. The statute of limitations requiring prosecution for espionage within 3 years after the crime had been committed had already long expired. Now why is yeah, you could rob some old lady's lunch money or pocketbook and probably get caught 5 years later. I don't know, but the statute of limitations for espionage being only 3 years sounds ridiculous to me.
Or if you're a Ukrainian, you can stand outside of a detention camp in Poland in 1944, and then in 1995 they can haul you away to Germany.
Right, from the United States. But if you sell out the United States 3 years and 2 days ago, oops, sorry, the statute of limitations is up. That's it. Well, that's Richard Nixon accusing the Roosevelt administration of gross negligence, but it demonstrates that since 1939 and all along, the Roosevelt administration had to know that these men that they were promoting up through the ranks in the State Department were communists, particularly Alger Hiss. And Alger Hiss had much influence at Yalta. He had much influence with the Roosevelt administration's China policy and with the founding documents of the United Nations. It's just incredible that this man, that nobody just arrested him. Because I don't understand, and I have one source that I'll probably quote later on, where it talks about the FBI. And it talks about the FBI knowing Alger Hiss was a communist, and the source says that nobody ordered an investigation. Well, you know something? I underwent an FBI investigation, and I don't think anybody had to order it. I don't know when the cop has to be ordered to enforce the law, and even when he sees a lawbreaker, I don't know that somebody has to order him to arrest that lawbreaker. I just don't get that. I don't get that. That's just not true. It doesn't wash in everyday life.
So if you're walking the beat and see a mugging in progress, nobody has to order you to stop the mugging.
Well, right. And if the FBI knew that Alger Hiss was a communist, then they dropped the ball totally. And it can be proven that they knew it.
And
what? That they sat around making up the excuse that nobody ordered an investigation? Well, they should have been investigating his boss too.
Well, how would they have known he was a communist in the first place if there hadn't been an investigation?
Well, how come when it comes to the Jews and the communists that we advocate authority in this country? Well, we just advocate our own authority. Oh, nobody ordered me to do that, so I didn't do nothing about it. It's absolutely. I mean, we should know why. It's the hand of Yahweh who said that we would be punished by these people until we repented.
And they're
However, that doesn't let these bastards off the hook for not doing anything about this. They're bigger traitors than Alger Hiss is. It's absolutely incredible. It's a total. I never saw anything like it. It's the way the media apologizes for them. Oh, nobody ordered them to investigate. Well, damn it, they didn't have to investigate. They knew it. It's crazy. And the media just runs cover for all this. And what's really going on behind the scenes is that they were probably ordered not to do anything about it. Because Roosevelt was a damn communist, and he wanted the world to be communist. That's the only logical conclusion to draw from this.
That Roosevelt, he wanted the Soviet Union to rule the world.
Well, right. When Richard Nixon himself was investigated, who ordered that investigation? How did they investigate the president? It's crazy. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And the media covers for it with the language that they use. The language they use exposes the media, that they're part of a conspiracy against our nation. And nobody sees it. The people, the common man, and even the average academic, they don't see the cognitive dissonance built into the language that the media uses to explain these things. It's absolutely incredible. Well, anyway, that's Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon proves in 1962 that the Roosevelt administration was not doing anything at all, and knew Alger Hiss was a communist and refused to do anything about it from 1930. So they kept promoting him. Oh, he's a communist? Good, we'll promote him. What does that tell you? They were looking for communists. They wanted communists at the top of the State Department. That's what it tells you. And Richard Nixon admits it, 1962. I don't think he realizes the implications of his statements. I really don't.
So he's getting to the truth, but he's still several steps away from it. He just doesn't realize how close he is to the truth. It's far worse than the picture he has in his mind of negligent, naive officials who are unwittingly being used as dupes.
Absolutely. Well, here's the section on China in the Conservapedia article on Alger Hiss. If you want to read it, I got a few things to say about China when we get through these two paragraphs.
Starting with the China section?
Yes.
During pre-conference negotiations with British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden regarding the war with Japan, what do we know about Anthony Eden?
I don't know a whole lot about Anthony Eden, except that he was the British Prime Minister.
He was the Prime Minister?
He was the British Prime Minister after Churchill, I'm fairly certain. And then Churchill was Prime Minister again, I think, in the mid-50s for a short stint.
Ah, all right. I remember that, yes, because Churchill was very disgruntled and upset, and he kind of went away in a huff, all mad and basically acting like a Jew, saying that the British didn't appreciate him, but then he came back later. Anyway, regarding the war with Japan, quote, Mr. Hiss brought up the question of China, end quote, according to Stettinius, quote, and stressed the importance which the United States attaches to U.S., British, Soviet encouragement and support for an agreement between the Communists and the Chinese Congress, end quote. The British, due to their interests in Hong Kong and Singapore, had influence with the Kuomintang, but none with the Communists. The Soviets, who did have influence with the Communists, were not present because they were not at war with Japan. The only effect Hiss had in bringing up the issue, therefore, was to co-opt the British to pressure the Chinese government into acquiescing to a Kremlin-backed power-sharing agreement with the rebels, thus granting a measure of legitimacy to forces dedicated to its destruction, a policy that Acheson would subsequently use as a pretext to obstruct aid to China, a move that would prove catastrophic for the Chinese. And of course, when the Soviets moved into Manchuria and captured the Japanese army in Manchuria, they turned over not only the territory, but all the weapons that the Japanese had to the undersupplied, ill-equipped communists, now giving them a huge amount of weaponry.
Absolutely.
The Americans should have stopped that. If we were dedicated to stopping communism, we would have stopped the handover of Manchuria to the Chinese communists.
Right, and a lot of that, I have a few things to say about that, but a lot of those weapons came back later to haunt us in North Korea.
Certainly, and there were some British authorities, too, who wanted to arm Japanese prisoners of war and use them to help patrol areas and curtail against the rise of the Chinese communists. And those suggestions were all basically denied, and those ideas had to be scrapped.
Well, all of those people were absolutely naive as to the true intentions of the Roosevelt administration, the State Department and the Truman administration, and the Wall Street and British bankers.
Ultimately, Roosevelt made a secret agreement with Stalin. Churchill was not informed, giving Moscow rights to the main Manchurian Railroad and territory in northern China. U.S. Ambassador to China Patrick J. Hurley resigned in protest, alleging the existence of a communist conspiracy within the State Department. Hiss would later deny under oath any role in China policy at Yalta or in the subsequent State Department proclamation calling for peace and unity with the communists in China, saying, quote, it was not in my area of activity at all, end quote. Hiss admitted that he had been connected with Far Eastern affairs before, but protested that after about February 1944, a year before he stressed the importance of unity with the communists, quote, I was assigned to United Nations work and specialized entirely in that field thereafter, end quote. Well, the UN didn't exist in 1944, so how could he have been working for the UN in 1944? I guess he didn't have an explanation for that.
I have a few things to say about this, about China, and it's not really complete, but it'll lend to our understanding of what happened there, and we should probably do a program entirely on the perfidy, the treachery that the United States committed against nationalist China, where they should have been supporting them, and instead we were openly supporting the communists and making public statements that we really supported the nationalists while our actions supported the communists, what was just incredible, and that's exactly what happened. And I'm going to read two lines from Wikipedia. The People's Republic of China was established on October 1st, 1949. It was the culmination of over two decades of civil and international war. From 1954 to 1959, Mao was the chairman of the PRC. During this period, Mao was called Chairman Mao or the Great Leader Chairman Mao. But let me say that they said nothing in Wikipedia about the 25, 30-year policy of the Bolsheviks and the Soviets to groom and grow this Communist Party in China, intending to take it over, intending to subvert nationalist China and make it a communist country. And actually, they had hoped to join it to the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, right?
So it's a fluke that Mao came into power.
Right. Here's what Viktor Suvorov says of the aftermath of the war in Asia from pages 274 to 275 of The Chief Culprit. Officially, the Soviet military campaign in the Far East lasted 24 days, but battles only took place for 12 days. Not even 2 weeks had passed before a massive surrender of Japanese troops began. Japanese losses numbered, and he's talking about the Soviet Eastern Campaign, right? Japanese losses numbered 84,000 killed and 594,000 taken prisoner. Among the prisoners were 148 Japanese generals. Unbelievable trophies were captured. The results of the operation were enviable. The United States had fought against Japan for almost 4 years, and what did it receive? I think we got Wake Island out of the deal, right? I'm being facetious, but we didn't receive much, right? The Soviet Union fought against Japan for 12 days, and all of China, North Korea, and North Vietnam fell under the Soviet Union's control. Vasilevsky happily reported, quote, "By delivering a crushing blow to Japanese troops in Korea, the Soviet army created favorable conditions for the activities of revolutionaries." That they had been sponsoring those revolutionaries all along. In the northern sections of the country, workers led by communists began to build the first truly independent, democratic — that's important, because I'm going to quote something else that's even crazier — democratic nation in Korean history. As a result of Japan's defeat, favorable conditions were created in China, North Korea, and North Vietnam for the victory of people's revolutions. The Chinese People's Army of Liberation received huge supplies of trophy arms, military equipment, and supplies. The defeat of Japanese militarism opened the way for national liberation movements throughout Asia. On September 2nd, when the Japanese Foreign Affairs Minister Shigemitsu and Chief of Staff Umezu signed the Pact of Total Capitulation, President Ho Chi Minh declared the birth of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. On October 12th, the Laos Patriots pronounced the birth of Phetet Lao. So we see that the communist takeover of Asia, not only China, but of Asia, began immediately.
And you know, the U.S., when the U.S., there was so much pressure to send material aid to the French who were trying to retake French Indochina, that's Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. A lot of the merchant marines and the dock workers in the U.S. on the West Coast went on strike. They refused to load the ships with the munitions and the rations that were being sent to help the French, and then the sailors refused to pilot the ships that were going to head to South Asia.
Well, right. We fought against ourselves virtually in the Southeast Asian wars. We committed all the crimes that built up to getting our boys slaughtered in Korea and in Vietnam.
That can't be by coincidence or mistake or a fluke that all these dock workers suddenly went on strike in a show of solidarity with the People's Republic of Vietnam against the French by refusing to load the ships. Obviously, somebody was pulling their strings.
In order to show the Oriental perception of the United States, and this is from IRChina.org, and it's an academic Chinese site, and it's pro-communist, of course. But the main source, the original source for this article, is the Harvard University Asia Center Triangular Relations Conference. Right, they're shooting for a political menage a trois there. Now, on July 4th, 1944. The Liberation Daily, which was a communist newspaper, right, in Yan'an, published an editorial entitled "Best Wishes for the U.S. National Day, a Great Day for Freedom and Democracy." Now, these are communists in China writing this, right? When they think democracy, they think what it really means, power of the people, and basically that democracy to them is communism.
Absolutely.
To us, we were never supposed to be a democracy in this country. We're supposed to be a constitutional republic that respects property rights, and we form a government so that we have what? A common defense against people that want to take our property. Well, this government was formed to prevent people from taking our property, and for the last 100 years, the government's been in the business of taking our property, not in the business of defending us from these outside aliens that want to take it. The government's joined sides with the aliens. That happened in 1913. Okay. So we see that, and let me just read two paragraphs in this article. On July 4th, 1944, the Liberation Daily in Yan'an published an editorial entitled Best Wishes for U.S. National Day, a Great Day for Freedom and Democracy. The editorial read, Democratic America now has a partner, and the work of Sun Yat-sen now has its successor. They are the CCP and other democratic forces. The work that we communists are now undertaking is the same work previously undertaken by Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and others in the United States. That's absolutely incredible. The United States is and will continue to be sympathetic to our cause. It is making great efforts to aid China in the resistance war against Japan and her democratic campaign. In other words, the communists in China know that the United States is democratic, just like them, and that we're supporting them. That's their attitude, July 4th, 1944. That's absolutely incredible. The editorial was personally vetted by Mao Zedong, right? Showing how deeply convinced the CCP leaders were that the goals of the United States were similar to their own. In other words, they don't draw the same distinctions that the common American people are drawing. That communism is the antithesis to democracy is what we've been taught by our media. But they've been taught that communism and democracy are one and the same.
And we know that if you have democracy, eventually you will have communism because it's my role.
Well, absolutely. Democracy is something that we were never supposed to have. Democracy is absolutely antithetical to the United States Constitution. But the Jewish media, when it established itself, the word democracy was never used by a government official to describe this government. It was used by some of the French Jews to describe the government of the founding fathers, but it was never used here until Woodrow Wilson. I have no record of it being used here before then. And it was Woodrow Wilson who gave us what? Woman's suffrage, the Federal Reserve, all the policies that got us into the mess that we're in came to us in Woodrow Wilson's administration.
He was basically their boy, wasn't he?
He was the American Nero, there's no doubt. He gave Rome away, there's no doubt. He sent Rome straight to the fire. He sent this nation straight to the fire. While he played with somebody else's wife. Well, that's an authentic article that demonstrates that the Chinese communists thought that fully that America was on their side and that our cause was their cause, which is nuts. Okay, the Iron Curtain over America, Chapter 5. John Beatty said this. He said, important also is a slanted guide to library selections by Oliver Carlson in the Freeman for January 14, 1952, dealing in more detail with books in one specific field, the China Theater, where our wrong policies have cost so many young American lives, is an article entitled The Grave Diggers of America, Part 1. The book reviewers sell out China. Now I believe I have this book archived and or at least images of it archived at the Mein Kampf site, but I didn't look into that. It's by Ralph De Toledano, who published it in the American Mercury, July 1951, pages 72 to 78, and part two in August of the same year. Mr. De Toledano explains that America's China policy, whether by coincidence or as part of a sharply conceived and shrewdly carried out plan, has led to the fact that, quote, China is Russia's. When China went communist, a lot of people understood that from that time, China belonged to Russia. The media here played up that China and Russia were opponents. But we see in Viktor Suvorov and the chief culprit that he also perceived that China, after World War II, when it went communist, was basically handed over to Russia. Mr. De Toledano then turns his attention to the State Department. Meanwhile, the real lobby, the four-plus propagandists of pro-communist line in Asia, prospered. Its stooges were able to see such a stranglehold on the State Department's Far Eastern Division that to this day, as we slug it out with the Chinese Reds, they are still unbudgeable. And he's writing during later on during the Korean War. While at the time, as we discussed last week, Beatty was dismissed as not having any documentation for his claims made in his book, we see today that they could certainly be supported. And Suvorov supports Beatty's claims. And I'm going to read a small couple of paragraphs from the hearings regarding communist espionage in the United States government. Wednesday, August 25th, 1948, United States House of Representatives Committee on Un-American Activities, Washington, D.C. This is from the testimony of Alger Hiss, accompanied by his counsel, his lawyer, John F. Davis. This should not taint the hearings themselves. But there's an interesting note here that I'm going to make a little later on about the chairman of these hearings. The chairman of these hearings is John Parnell Thomas, and something really, I think, pretty interesting happened to him after these hearings transpired, or actually while they were going on. Let me read the part from the hearings first. This is from the transcripts of the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1948. The chairman, who is John Parnell Thomas, the chairman, Mr. Counsel, you have something here, something there that you wanted to bring up some time ago. What is that? Davis, Alger Hiss's lawyer, says, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will you bear with me? It won't take but just a minute. It seems as if it is an ancient story now, but after Mr. Mundt made his statements, I felt I wanted to refer the committee to a statement made by Mr. Mundt during the hearing, meaning the prior one, the first public hearing at which Mr. Hiss's name came up, and I would just like to read the two paragraphs. Now, Carl Earl Mundt was an American educator and a Republican member of the United States Congress representing South Dakota in the United States House of Representatives from 38 to 48, and that includes this hearing here, and he went on to become a senator from 48 to 73. Mr. Mundt says, Mr. Chambers, I am very much interested in trying to check the career of Alger Hiss. I know nothing about Donald Hiss, but as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Personnel Committee, I have had some occasion to check the activities of Alger Hiss while he was in the State Department. There is reason to believe that he organized within the department, the State Department, one of the communist cells which endeavored to influence our Chinese policy and bring about the condemnation of Chiang Kai-shek.
Well, you mentioned Donald Hiss. Donald Hiss, apparently, we haven't discussed him that much, have we?
No, but he was Alger Hiss's brother, and he also worked for the State Department.
And he
remember
was
that Alger Hiss, as we demonstrated earlier in this series, had a lot of influence with Franklin Roosevelt and also recommended a lot of his fellow communists for jobs in the State Department.
Donald Hiss was employed by the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. He was also a secretary and a law clerk to a Supreme Court justice. Then he was a special attorney in the Department of Justice. He was also a special Senate committee member investigating the munitions industry. And then he was also known as a communist who helped pass information to the Soviets, and the FBI had him under investigation.
Well, right, but they were never ordered to do anything about it, so they didn't.
and a KGB operative told the FBI that, you know, he fingered Alger Hiss and Donald Hiss.
Well, yeah, they've been fingered for years, but nobody ever did anything about it. Everybody knew they were communists. They were only one small aspect of the way in which the Roosevelt administration was totally saturated with communists. But I mean, Dean Acheson and Morgenthau, and there were a ton of them, that Harry Hopkins, Harry Dexter White, and hopefully before this year's out, we'll get to talk about a few more of them. But Alger Hiss is only the most he's the most striking to me, because he was actually at Yalta. He was with Gerald Nye when Gerald Nye was battling these Jewish bankers that were financing these wars, right? Alger Hiss was right there, and World War II was right around the corner. And even in spite of Gerald Nye's findings in the Senate committee in the mid-1930s, we still let the bankers draw us into World War II. And there's no doubt, and even in Adolf Hitler's mind, Adolf Hitler, before the war, made public announcements that it was the Jewish bankers drawing us into World War II. And we saw from documentation that we presented over the last couple of weeks that it was the Wall Street, the characters on Wall Street that got Franklin Roosevelt to sign up with them in this economic war against the Nazis and against Hitler's Germany. That there's no doubt that Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, was just a whore for the Jewish bankers, and that he himself was a communist and lined his administration with communists.
And if we wanted to sit here naming communist traitors and infiltrators and spies within our own government, we could be here for the next 10 years.
Well, yes, we probably could. Right up to, I don't know, name your administration. Ever since the Truman administration, it says, name your administration, and we could name the communists. But look at Jimmy Carter, Henry Kissinger, and I can't even pronounce his damn name, Zbigniew Brzezinski. He's a total communist. It's incredible. Every administration. The neocons are communists. They call themselves neocons, new conservatives, but they were a bunch of Jewish Bolshevik coffeehouse denizens that infiltrated the Republican Party. Every one of them was a former Bolshevik, all the prominent neocons. And Bill Kristol is John Lennon's grandson. William Kristol, one of the leading so-called neocons, is the grandson of John Lennon. It's absolutely incredible. George Bush, what's her name? I can never remember her name. I'm sorry. Bill Kristol was the grandson of Leon Trotsky, and so was that woman that George Bush put in charge of the drug enforcement agency in this country. I can't remember her name.
Granddaughter, right? Nora Volkow.
Nora Volkow, that's it. Nora Volkow. She is also a grandchild of Leon Trotsky's.
She's the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
So is William Kristol, a grandson of Leon Trotsky's, I've learned recently. And he's a leading neocon. Well, let me continue with this. But let me continue. Mr. Munt says, Mr. Chambers, I am very much interested in trying to check the career of Alger Hiss. I know nothing about Donald Hiss. But as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Personnel Committee, I have had some occasion to check the activities of Alger Hiss while he was in the State Department. There is reason to believe that he organized within the department one of the communist cells which he endeavored to influence our Chinese policy and bring about the condemnation of Chiang Kai-shek. Now we see that he's saying this in 1948. Well, it happened, which put Marzani in an important position there, and I think it is important to know what happened to these people after they leave the government. Do you know where Alger Hiss is employed now? Mr. Munt, Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a statement. The chairman, Mr. Munt. I am glad you read that, Mr. Counsel, because I was going to make that statement now, and I won't have to do it. In connection with the statement in the letter of Mr. Hiss, in which he implied or gave the impression that my disagreement with American foreign policy was because he had been connected with it, and I would not want it to go out that my only disagreement with some of these policies is because of your connection with them. As far as I am concerned, Mr. Hiss, our policy toward China, the political agreement at Yalta, which you said you helped write, and the Morgenthau Plan, which you mentioned, three of them are hopelessly bad, and I shall continue to consider them hopelessly bad even though you prove yourself to be president of the American Daughters of the Revolution. He's being tongue-in-cheek. But Alger Hiss admitted helping write our Yalta policy. He wrote the charter for the United Nations, so that was a communist instrument from the ground up, and he helped write the Morgenthau Plan. And he admitted them all before this House Un-American Activities Committee. The fact that you were connected with them may or may not, when these hearings have terminated, increase my skepticism about their wisdom. It is true, as I said in my summation, that as a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, I have had brought to my attention several times the mention of the name Alger Hiss in connection with our Chinese policy. Now you read that they said that he denied any connection with it, right? It is also true that after listening to him testify the following day, I said publicly and I said in the record that he had been a very persuasive and convincing witness and had very well convinced me of his reliability. In fact, I advised Mrs. Munt at dinner last night that, and she said that I had been taken in by his suavity. Remember that when we started doing this, that Alger Hiss was, he was described as a very dashing and suave individual, right? Perhaps a woman's intuition is better than a man's, I do not know, but at all events, I am willing again to state that Mr. Hiss was a willing and persuasive witness as far as I am concerned. I would like to say just one other thing with regard to that one part of the letter, Mr. Chairman, which says that it is inconceivable that he, Mr. Hiss, would have worked in the government for these many years and still have been a member of the Communist Party or disloyal. That it is not inconceivable to me, without in any way attempting at this time to indict the credibility of Mr. Hiss, but I wish to point out that John Purifoy, Assistant Secretary of State in charge of security, has notified Congress that 134 members of the Communist Party had weaseled their way into the State Department alone and that had been removed from the department for disloyal reasons. And Munt goes on to state that he figures it could very easily be 135 members, meaning to indicate that Mr. Hiss, Alger Hiss, is the 135th member.
Purifoy didn't live that long. He died at age 48.
Well, right, but he's stating that Purifoy had pointed this out in the past, not in these hearings, right?
I'm just saying that it seems that people that raise the alarm don't live too long.
Well, right, and that's what I want. Well, I want to continue with people that raise the alarm here before we move on with the Conservapedia article. All right, but first, I want to show that, and I read that this piece from Mr. Munt, from Congressman Munt, and his examination of Alger Hiss to show that in 1948. Congress was very concerned of not only the communists in the State Department, but of the outcome of the events at Yalta in connection with those communists and the implementation of this policy in China through these communists running the State Department. They knew it was going on. That they just, I don't know, the wheels of justice grind too slowly, and the wheels of history outrun them. Yeah, you know, that's the way it is. I'm going to read something also from the chief culprit here before I get into this. That I probably should have read it before. It's to show how we helped the Russians in Japan. That when it came time to divvy up Asia, Russia really had no bargaining chips, right? I mean, they only, as Suvorov said, they were freely given all this territory. Even though the American public wasn't aware of it, basically, when North Korea and North Vietnam and China all went communist, that was a big gift to Russia, right? And Suvorov,
we had to give it to them on a platter.
Suvorov talks about the Soviet, the Soviet forces in Asia that were redirected after the defeat of Germany and sent to Asia. And he talks about 1.7 million men and 5,000 tanks and 5,000 airplanes and this great army that the Soviets, after the fall of Germany, were able to build up and send to Asia. And then he goes on to say that a stream of cargo flowed in from the United States at the same time Soviet forces were being transferred out of Central and Eastern Europe, meaning to Asia, right, to the East.
Oh, I'd like to point out, too, could I read real quick from The Last Empress, Madam Chiang Kai-shek and the Birth of Modern China?
Well, let me get this point across, since I just introduced the whole thing, right? A stream of cargo flowed in from the United States at the same time Soviet forces were being transferred out of Central Europe and Eastern Europe. Stalin was the most cunning diplomat of the 20th century. Let me say that Suvorov gives Stalin way too much credit, right? He gives Stalin all the credit for everything, and he downplays the Lend-Lease Act and all the American assistance, and he downplays the international bankers' role in Stalin's successes. Stalin was the most cunning diplomat of the 20th century, Suvorov says. He demanded that the president of the United States supply food and fuel for all Soviet troop formations. That means that we supply, they were able to put this 1.7 million man army together to go to Japan, to go fight the Japanese in Korea, but we supplied all the food and the fuel. That's half the battle. I mean, if you don't have the logistics, you aren't fighting the war. An agreement was reached with the United States about the concentration of 3 months' supplies and fuels for our troops in this theater of military operations. The United States also supplied airplanes, armored cars, automobiles, radios, telephone cables, medicines, optical devices, and much more.
So in other words, we gave them the green light.
Well, we gave them everything, it seems. They weren't fighting Japan for 12 days without us supplying all the food and fuel. I mean, we gave them a three-month supply, and they fought Japan for 12 days, and they get awarded with all of China and North Vietnam and half of Europe and North Korea, and we get Wake and Midway, right? And an Air Force base in Rhineland.
Manchuria was the most industrially rich part of China as well. Could I read about the Soviet sack of Manchuria real quick? This is page
29, go ahead.
The Last Empress by Madame Chiang Kai-shek and the Birth of Modern China by Hannah Pukala. During the 6 days preceding the official end of the war, it was estimated that about 700,000 Russian soldiers had moved into Manchuria, looting the factories and industries of the northern province, and stripping the area of at least $1 billion in assets. Note, some estimates say $2 billion. According to the first foreign businessman to follow them there, they had destroyed about 80% of the city of Mukden, bringing in their soldiers who had taken Berlin and turning them loose for 3 days of rape and pillage. Later, they relieved these troops with two convict divisions from the salt mines of Siberia who, quote, stole everything in sight, broke up bathtubs and toilets with hammers, pulled electric light wiring out of the plaster, built fires on the floor, and either burned down the houses or at least put a big hole in the floor, and in general, behaved completely like savages. More than 1 million Japanese soldiers have been left stranded in China proper and another 1 million in Manchuria, all waiting to be repatriated. Close to 1 million Chinese puppet troops who had served the government of Wang Qingwei were also scattered around the country, 600,000 or so in China proper and another 350,000 in Manchuria. And then it just goes on to discuss what happens with them. And it's interesting to note that all of their weapons and all of their equipment were turned over to the communists. But the Soviets also got to loot all the industry of Manchuria, which was the most developed part of China at the time. I'm sure that proved a huge boost to their economy.
Well, you were talking about absolutely. Yeah, you were talking about what happens to whistleblowers before, right? And I want to talk for a minute about this J. Parnell Thomas, because he was the chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee while Alger Hiss was being investigated. He was the chairman that was being referred to when I was reading those quotes from Congressman Mundt, right? Mm-hmm. And Jay Parnell, now he's not, he doesn't seem to be a totally unshady individual, right? He seems like the typical politician, there's no doubt. But I think this is important to illustrate. Jay Parnell Thomas was a stockbroker and politician. He lived from 1895 to 1970. He was elected to 7 terms as a U.S. representative from New Jersey. He was later a convicted criminal who served 9 months in federal prison for corruption. Born as John Parnell Feeney, Jr. in Jersey City, New Jersey, he changed his name in 1919 to John Parnell Thomas. They don't explain why. I don't have a whole lot of Irishmen changing their names, but he might be one of them. Raised Catholic, he later became an Episcopalian. Maybe there's no political future as a Feeney in the 1900s. After graduating from high school, he went on to study at the University of Pennsylvania. When the United States joined World War I in 1917, he served overseas with the U.S. Army. Following his discharge from the military in 1919, Thomas worked in the investment securities and insurance business in New York City for the next 18 years. He entered Allendale, New Jersey, municipal politics in 1925 and was elected to council, then mayor, between 1926 to 1930. He was elected to a 2-year term in the New Jersey General Assembly in 1935. In 1936, he was elected to the United States House of Representatives as a Republican Party representative from New Jersey's 7th Congressional District, filling the vacancy left by the death of Randolph Perkins. He would be reelected 6 times. As a U.S. congressman, Thomas was a staunch conservative opponent of President Franklin D. Roosevelt and his New Deal, claiming the president's legislative agenda had sabotaged the capitalist system. Thomas opposed government support for the Federal Theater Project, declaring that practically every play presented under the auspices of the project is sheer propaganda for communism or the New Deal. I would say the New Deal was communism. In 1949, Thomas called the U.S. Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, the most dangerous man in America, and claimed that if Forrestal were not removed from office, he would cause another world war. Following the Republican Party gaining control of the 80th Congress, Thomas was appointed chairman of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. In May 1947, Thomas traveled to Hollywood to meet with film industry executives with a view to exposing what he believed was communist infiltration of motion pictures. Too bad he didn't realize that those film industry executives were all Jews and they were all communists too, right? With a view to exposing what he believed was communist infiltration of motion pictures content by the members of the Screenwriters Guild, among them being Ronald Reagan. Maybe he was in the Screen Actors Guild. Returning to Washington, D.C., he shifted the focus of the committee to what he called the subversives working in the film business. At Los Angeles is City of the Fallen Angels, right? Under Thomas, in October 1947, HUAC summoned suspected communists to appear for questioning. These summonses led to the conviction and imprisonment for contempt of Congress of the Hollywood 10, who had refused to answer the committee's questions, citing the First Amendment. Prominent American columnists Jack Anderson and Drew Pearson were critical of Thomas and his committee's methods. Rumors about corrupt practices, and let me say Jack Anderson was always a commie liberal, and he was writing for the New York Daily News when I was still a kid. Rumors about corrupt practices on the part of Thomas were confirmed when his secretary, Helen Campbell, sent documents to Pearson, the columnist, which he used to expose Thomas's corruption in an August 4, 1948 newspaper article. The fraud had begun on New Year's Day of 1940 when Thomas placed Myra Midkiff on his payroll as a clerk, earning roughly $1,200 a year, with the arrangement that she would then kick back all her salary to the congressman, thus supplementing his income and avoiding taxes. The arrangement lasted for 4 years. As a result, Thomas was summoned to answer to charges of salary fraud before a grand jury. This is what hung him right here.
Well, I have to wonder, though, Bill, what's the point of What's her benefit in this arrangement if she's kicking back all of her salary to him? What does she get out of the deal?
Well, right. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but Thomas got hurt, I think. It sounded to me like he got trafficanted, right? Like Jim Trafficant, he got trafficanted. Where he got hurt was that he refused to answer the grand jury. Thomas refused to answer questions, citing his Fifth Amendment rights, the same stance for which he had criticized accused communists. Indicted, Thomas was tried and convicted of fraud and given an 18-month prison sentence. He resigned from Congress on January 2nd, 1950. In another twist, he was imprisoned in Danbury Prison, that's in Connecticut, with Lester Cole and Ring Lardner Jr., both who were members of the Hollywood Ten serving time because of Thomas's inquiries into the film industry. I wonder if they played cards together. After his release from prison, Thomas was an editor and publisher of three weekly newspapers in Bergen County, New Jersey. President Harry S. Truman pardoned Thomas on Christmas Eve, 1952, a Democrat pardoning a Republican. In 1954, Thomas tried to re-enter politics, but was defeated for the Republican Party nomination for Congress. It's amazing that this man was exposing the communists in the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they got something on him and put him in prison. It's the story of American politics, right? They're all crooked. It seems to me that they all have something that could put them away. Maybe that they wouldn't get to where they are in the first place if they didn't.
And I have to wonder, you know, people like Ron Paul, if they had any kind of dirt on him, they'd have brought it out by now. So he must be pretty clean.
Well, he must be clean, or he must be doing what they want him to do. Maybe he's a controlled opposition, too, and I wonder about that, the way he sort of threw in the towel in the primary elections 4 years ago. He seems to have been designed to give the election to McCain. I mean, it's that's the way I saw that primary is unfolding. We'll never know. Not in the near future, anyway.
So who ordered the investigation of J. Parnell Thomas? If no investigation could be ordered against Hiss, who ordered the investigation against Thomas?
Well, that's part of that. That is part of the hypocrisy of the left, and people don't see that hypocrisy. It's incredible.
And like you said, who ordered the investigation against Nixon?
Right.
The premier of the Soviet Union.
Probably. Well, that's the. That's all I have to say for now about China. I mean, I would like to say more later, maybe perhaps when we talk about Truman and Vietnam, or Truman and Korea, and if we get that far in the series this year, right?
Would you like to continue with the Hiss Conservapedia?
Yes, absolutely. Traitors. The Soviets, already covertly informed of Roosevelt's declining health, bugged the U.S. quarters and listened avidly on February 4th, 1945. Hiss accompanied FDR to his meeting with Churchill and Stalin. According to Robert Louis Benson, former technical director for counterintelligence at the National Security Agency, and Cecil Phillips, a cryptanalyst who was instrumental in cracking the Soviet code.
Well, they wouldn't need to be informed, because you look at Roosevelt back then, he looked like a zombie.
Right. The Russians came to the table with ample knowledge of our purposes and attitudes through information provided to them by traitors whose deeds ultimately were revealed in Venona. That's when the Russian secret documents were decoded in the Venona manuscripts, and Alger Hiss was exposed in those documents. But Venona is not the only source. According to Harvard historian Sergei Plocky, new evidence from the Soviet archives supports the thesis that Hiss was a Soviet spy at the time of the Yalta Conference. One of the officials at Yalta we had established confidential relations with was Alger Hiss, who was, according to Pseudo-Platov, highly sympathetic to the interests of the Soviet Union, him and the rest of the Roosevelt administration, right? According to confidential GRU sources, during the conference, Hiss gave daily briefings to Stalin's military advisor, General Mikhail Abramovich Mishstein. He doesn't sound very Russian, does he?
He sounds like a Ukrainian.
Yeah, right. He sounds like a Jew. Deputy Director of the GRU. He's certainly a Jew. Revealing not only the American negotiating strategy, but insights into the attitudes of the American negotiators, Pseudo-Platov added, quote, in conversation, Hiss disclosed to Umansky and then Litvinov official U.S. attitudes and plans. He was also very close to our sources who were cooperating with Soviet intelligence and to our active intelligence operators in the United States. Within this framework of exchange of confidential information were references to Hiss as the source who told us the Americans were prepared to make a deal in Europe. Well, I would bet Hiss had everything to do with that preparation in the first place.
Oh, and Litvinov, his real name wasn't Litvinov. He was born Meyer Heinock Moshtowich Wallach.
I don't think he's a Ukrainian either. Poland. When Roosevelt asked the Secretary of State to get a lawyer to consult with him over the wording of the Polish boundary statement, wrote Stettinius, I called Alger Hiss. Imagine that. The U.S. ended up ceding eastern Poland to the Soviet Union, essentially ratifying what Eden called the Ribbentrop-Molotov line, the deal Stalin had made with Hitler and the secret protocols of the Nazi-Soviet pact. As Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post columnist, well, that just means she's a sellout, but so does her name, Anne Applebaum put it, Yalta went beyond mere recognition of Soviet occupation and conferred legality and international acceptance on new borders and political structures. It was agreed to keep these plans entirely secret. U.S. Ambassador to Poland, Arthur Bliss Lane, resigned in protest, writing, as I glanced over the document, I could not believe my eyes. To me, almost every line spoke of a surrender to Stalin. It's almost like America lost the war to the Russians, right?
So if someone asks, who won World War II, the answer is the Jews.
Right. Well, absolutely. And that's we should have realized that years ago. I've been saying that. I said that quite often, I think, early in the series. The answer to who won World War II is the Jews. Period. Other secret agreements. Another secret agreement gave the Soviet Union 3 votes in the United Nations to 1 vote for the United States. Later, urging Roosevelt to tell the U.S. delegation to the U.N. founding conference the whole truth about this agreement, which he called this X matter. Stettinius would advise FDR, who would be dead in less than a month, to have Hiss with him when he broke the news to the American delegates. This agreement would not be disclosed until 1947. And that doesn't make it binding because the U.S. president agreed to it. We're only bound by treaties that the U.S. Senate ratifies. And then another Senate could undo that if they had any balls. According to James F. Burns, then director of the Office of War Mobilization and Reconversion, he and others returned from Yalta to Washington on February 10th, but Roosevelt stayed behind with a select few, including Hiss. We expected the conference would end that evening and that the president would leave the following day. But that afternoon, Stalin requested the president to remain one more day. He said they could not conclude their work and he wished to discuss some matter he deemed important. The president complied. The protocols were signed on February 11th. When the president returned, he did not mention it to me and the protocol was kept locked in his safe at the White House. Only after Roosevelt's death would Burns, then Secretary of State, learn due to a news story from Moscow, he wrote, of the full agreement. Although the conference ended February 11th, yet another secret codicil was added on March 31st, less than 2 weeks before FDR's death. This agreement would force the repatriation of some 2 million refugees, including 1.5 million POWs, to the Soviet Union for slave labor or death in the gulag. That agreement was kept secret from the American people for 50 years as William Henry Chamberlain, as we read last week, a one-time supporter of the Bolshevik regime, concluded the Yalta Agreement represented in two of its features the endorsement by the United States of the principle of human slavery. One of these features was a recognition that German labor could be used as a source of reparations, and the agreement that Soviet citizens who were found in the eastern zones of occupation should be handed over to the Soviet authorities amounted for the many Soviet refugees who did not wish to return to the enactment of a fugitive slave law. Well, that's what they don't understand, is under Talmudism, all the goyim are nothing but slaves. Asked if he had drafted or participated in the drafting of the parts of the Yalta Agreement, Hiss would testify, quote, "I think it is accurate and not an immodest statement to say that I did, to some extent, yes."
And if they had gotten their way, there would have been a Soviet occupation zone extending all the way to Portugal and Iceland.
Ireland, right. Well, right. And Alger Hiss admitted, as we saw in the testimony from Congressman Munt, that he did write parts of the Yalta Agreement and the UN Charter, and had a big hand in, even though he denied it later, had a big hand in setting up China policy. I mean, communists were running the entire post-war operation for the Roosevelt administration and continued into the Truman years, because a lot of those same people held the same or similar posts in the Truman administration.
All right, shall we continue from here or pick up next week then, sir? How do you want to
take it? Well, we should pick up in 2 weeks, because neither of us will be here next week.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay. So when we return, we will get more into China at some point, but also we have about one or two more weeks on Hiss, correct?
Yes, I thought we would get halfway through the remainder of Hiss tonight, and we only got not a third of the way through it. I'm sorry, but that there's a lot of important important things here to bring out that I don't want to let go with the water under the bridge, right? I think it's important.
The History Channel would tell me about it if it was important. All they said is that he was accused of being a communist and people wanted to crucify him.
Well, right, but he was a communist and he should have been crucified. Him and every other SOB in the Roosevelt administration should have been hung in the public square probably in 1935. It's absolutely incredible the way our people just lay down and buy the Jewish media line while we're getting screwed.
And I'm sure the greatest
generation. And we believe we're not getting screwed because some kike on the television is telling us, oh, don't worry, that man behind you, he's not screwing you. That's just a nervous reaction. You must need this medication over here. Buy this medication and that pain will go away.
And I'm certain if Roosevelt had survived and hadn't died in 45, the greatest generation would have elected him five or six more times.
Absolutely. The greatest generation of whores for the Jews.
He'd be president today if he were still alive.
Well, in the end, no matter what the Jews do, in the end, we win. That's the word of God. Praise Yahweh.
So, as you said, one day we can sit around and debate whether or not there were Jews.
Yes, today we debate whether or not there's a Holocaust. In 100 years, we're going to sit around and debate whether or not they were really Jews. Yes, sir.
So if somebody wants to see a Jew, they'll have to look in a history book.
Absolutely.
All right. Praise Yahweh. Thank you.
Praise Yahweh.